I suppose that must be most people now, so I'll begin. It's 8:05 already. So as I intended yesterday at the question time, this talk will be on the insight practices and how that fits into what we're doing already. I had already mentioned that it's very difficult to find any distinction between the practice of insight and the practice of calm. The practice is the same, it's just what that brings out, either the calm or the deep seeing into the nature of things, which really just, there's the only difference there. It's the same practice. In that simile of Mr. Vipassana and Mrs. Samatha, I always change them around, last time it was Mr. Samatha and Mrs. Vipassana. Whenever you have gender problems, you always have to change around the genders, otherwise I tend to get into trouble. So this time it was Mrs. Vipassana. That was last time, Mrs. Samatha, Mr. Vipassana. And in that simile you see that they go up the same mountain. The act of the practice is the same. But what we emphasize, what comes out of that practice, what we see at the end, or even at the middle, that's the only reason why we have these words, insight and calm. Insight is Vipassana, Samatha means calm. So there isn't really much difference there. But so far in this retreat I've been mentioning the calm. Now today I'm going to start mentioning the insight. In other words, the understanding, the realization, seeing what's going on is what we mean by the insight. And when we look at the insight in the path of meditation, it's first of all just the insight into, you know, what is meditation and how it works. What I call sometimes insight into the path itself, let alone any insights into the deeper meaning of things. As I hope I'll be able to show in this talk, the insight into the path actually just develops seamlessly into the insight into the great things such as Four Noble Truths and the nature of existence and who you are. There seems to be a natural, seamless development between one type of insight and the next. But the first insight one gets is basically, what is this meditation business? How does it work? And the sort of insights you get at first, you know, insights, you know, actually what is present moment? What is silence? And you should never look down on such insights, because most people in this world today have got very little idea what present moment actually means as an experience. Because ever since they were, maybe when they were a kid, they knew what the present moment was. But as they grow older, you get so engrossed in running around through time and doing the business of the world, that sometimes we don't even pause long enough to recollect the experience of now. And because of that, that it's fascinating for me as a teacher to go around teaching, you know, people meditation for the first time and just say, okay, just be in the present moment, or be in the present moment. And it's not as if they say, how do you do that? They say, what is it? Now, what is now? And it's such a shame that so many people have even lost the understanding and realization that they can't even really comprehend what it really means to be in this moment. So, by this time in the retreat, I think most of you, if any all of you, at least will know what that really means. What is the present moment? You get the insight into it, which is the experience-based understanding of what it is, how it is, how pleasant it is. And the more those insights build up the experience of the present moment, number one, the easier it is to go back there, because you understand exactly where you're going. It's like when you, this fellow, I remember he was a prison officer at Karna prison farm, and he was married to a Malaysian Buddhist, and he was a great friend. And actually I saw him last year at the retreat in Penang. The Chowpo and Agnes, remember this Western fellow came called Cal, wanted to see me. This was this guy. And I hadn't seen him for years. But anyhow, that he moved house into a new development in Armidale. And he said, he went to work at Karna Prison, just past my monastery. And then when he went back that afternoon, he couldn't find his house. Because it's a new suburb, and the latest town planning, you never have straight roads and grids. It always curves this way and curves that way. And he was going around for an hour. He had to call his wife on the phone and say, help, I'm in the suburb, so where are you? He couldn't even find his own house, because he'd only been there 1 or 2 days. And he didn't know the neighborhood.
And that's the same like present moment awareness. You may get there once, but how do you get back there again? Because you don't know the neighborhood, you're not familiar with it. But once you get familiar with these things, you get the insight into where your house is, how to get there, so you can get there whenever you want. Now that is Inkidai real insight, which is worth something. Because it's not the insights, it's intellectual insights where you can write a PhD on the nature of dependent origination. This is something which is real and which creates something very positive and valuable in your life. And this happens on every stage of the meditation. You get insight into what silence is. So silence is no longer a word, it's an experience. And it's because these insights are very much feely-feely experiences. This is one of the reasons why I say that the whole path, you know, is like getting more close to the emotional world, where you don't give things a name, you don't describe it to yourself, you don't know the world through words. You get to know the world through experiences. You know, it's more primal than the descriptive world. You go to the experiential world, the emotional world, because peace is an emotion, it's not a thought. It's great to understand that. So you're developing the real positive emotions. And the words are just one step away from reality, and actually they're not real. They're very false. But the emotions, that's real. You experience those, you feel those, the words are just superficial. So once you get into this, you get real deep insight into what these things actually are. What is peace? And crikey, I mean, people should give an arm and a leg. Maybe, you know, you've already given a couple of legs, really hurting, and a back, and many other sort of painful parts of your body to learn these things, but it's well worth it. Because you find out what these things actually are. What is silence? And the more you experience that, the more insight you get into what silence truly is. And its benefits. And once you know what it is and how to get there and its benefits, you're getting a long way in life. Because you can turn to that silence whenever you want. I don't know how many people sort of come to monks for counseling for things like they can't sleep well at night. Or they're worried about their business. Or they're worried about their relationship and they can't stop thinking about it. And for those of you who just learn that much in this retreat, how to be silent, you've come a long way in life. Because you know just how to calm that whole thinking mind down, which can drive people crazy. You know how to stop and just be. So those thoughts and those concepts just don't drive you mad. I think a lot of madness does come from a mind which thinks too much and gets into a way of thought, just like a repeated slogan goes on and on and on. You can't break out of it. Until it just wears you down and you go into craziness, some sort of psychosis. Just because the thinking goes way beyond bounds. In silence you never go crazy. In silence you go peaceful and also very mushy and nice. Because it's also you get the insight into the fact that these things are very, very pleasant states. But the insight must also come is actually how these things are brought about. And those insights into what actually works are probably even more profound than getting to understand what these states really are. It's how do you get into peace? How do you get into silence? How do you get into the present moment? Because many of those ways where you get into the stages of meditation are counterintuitive. Sometimes it doesn't make sense to people at first. So you have a retreat, you pay $300 for this, and you know, you've got some ideas, you want to get some peace, you want to get some deep meditation. And the first couple of days, I tell you to sleep. What's going on here? What's Ajahn Brahm up to? And is it I'm just trying to be kind to you, so that you can be kind back to me? I'm afraid of pushing you. And that's not the reason. The reason we do this is because it works. And I know this not just through practice, but because I have such insight into the nature of my mind. I know exactly how this thing works. And what you have is I encourage you to do these things and you relax. To be able to develop those states of mind, you do need to relax the body first of all. It is counterintuitive. And if ever you remember some of the stories of Buddhism, you'll understand that you're not the only one who thought it was counterintuitive. In the story of the Buddha's enlightenment, for 6 years he followed the ascetic way, pushing his body to the limit, like a 6-year-long Vipassana retreat. I don't mind giving that dig. And after 6 years, he got nowhere. All he got was frustrated. Because that's what controlling and craving lead to. Eventually, sometimes you succeed, sometimes you get somewhere. There's some rewards there. But all the rewards do is encourage you to more craving and more controlling. Sort of thinking that that's going to be the way. And there comes a time where you can't control the world, you can't control nature. And this is where just control freaks, what they usually respond if they can't control the nature is to try harder. Keep on forcing it. And that just makes them more tense and more frustrated, because the world is much bigger than them. But because of the ego, we think we can control it and do it. We can control our partner, we can control our business, we can control our body, we can control others. But we all come across, eventually, the brick wall. And we do, literally, bang our head against that brick wall. But remember, bricks are much harder than heads. So why are you keeping banging your head against that wall? You're never going to break through. You're just going to get a big bruise on your head and a headache. And that's all that happens when people control so much. They end up with frustration. And frustration usually gives rise to anger. That's what anger is. It's when you ask from the world what it can never give you. And you stop asking. You demand. You shout. You scream at the world. You don't realize that it can never give you what you're asking for. And with all that screaming, all that anger, eventually it leads to depression. When you give up. Not in the wise way. When you sort of, I can't do anything anymore. You lose your self-esteem, you lose your way in life, and just life is just too difficult. And this is usually what happens. I think this is one of the reasons why there's so much depression in our modern world, is because there are too many control freaks. And we've been encouraged with that control. However, that's a subject for somebody to get a PhD sometime in the future, but not here, where the depression comes from the controlling mind. But here, now in the Buddha's time, after 6 years of that, he gave up. And he decides to go for the middle way. In other words, resting, eating properly. For all of those of you who think, wow, the breakfasts on this retreat are too much, you know, we should be more simple with our breakfasts, then think what the Buddha had for breakfast before he became enlightened. He had this milk rice which was actually prepared for heavenly beings. So, I mean, sometimes I must admit the breakfast tastes so nice, I think it might be prepared for a heavenly being. But this is what the Buddha had. And he did not just, you know, sit sort of on the bare floor. He sat on grass cushions. He made himself a zafu, because it was comfortable for him. So you don't force the body. Now, when the Buddha started doing that, he had these five friends. You couldn't really call them disciples yet. They were just hangers-on who decided to, you know, befriend the Buddha and his striving. And for 6 years they were watching him, thinking, wow, this guy's trying so hard. If anyone's going to get enlightened, he is. Look how hard he strives. And when he gave up after 6 years, they said, he's just a scallywag. He's just a namby-pamby cream puff. He's given up. And they left him. That's why some people might say, what, you didn't get up at 4 o'clock in the morning every morning, you didn't sit for 7 hours, 10 hours a day, you're just namby-pamby cream puffs as well. This is Ajahn Brahm's namby-pamby cream puff retreat. And I think, oh, this is soft. If you want a real real meditation, you know, real enlightenment, you've got to really go for it. And that sort of attitude, obviously those five friends, that's what they thought. So as soon as they saw the Buddha taking this middle way, they just abandoned him. They just gave him up. Say, okay, you know, you're not going to get anywhere. Because it was counterintuitive. It didn't seem to make sense. But obviously it did make sense, because the Buddha became fully enlightened. That beautiful middle way is so subtle, and probably the greatest discovery of a Buddha. To find out that through this resting, through this calming, through this gentleness, through this loving kindness, through little by little being happy to be here, instead of striving to get somewhere else, you develop peace. And for those of you who follow the instructions and have slept in the mornings, congratulations, well done, you are my best disciples. Those people who got up 4 o'clock every morning, I'm very disappointed with you. You control freaks. Because you'll find, by experimenting this way, as you do, feel peaceful. You get an insight into just how to make the body and mind feel supple and workable for the task of meditation. For those of you who try very hard, you find, yeah, you can get up early and you can sit straight, but there's no softness there. You can't work the mind. It's like hard clay. So you're getting some insight in what you're doing here and how to create peace. Later on, when you really understand how the mind works, this is just experiential insight, it works. Later on, you'll find out why it works. And that why it works is the insight which I'll come into later on, I hope if I have time. The insight which I've mentioned already, the doer and the knower business. Understanding the mind, just, you know, the source of you, if you like, you know, the engine of you. Two parts to it, the knower and the doer. The mind's only got so much energy. And if you lose all that energy in just the doing things, struggling, working, striving, that does take energy. You know what it's like when you say, I'm going to sit for a half an hour, I'm going to get up in the morning. That takes a lot of mental energy. The trouble is that after you do that, you've got not much left. That's not how you generate energy. That's how you tire yourself out. So what one does, actually that's what the Buddha said, that extreme of the middle way, you know, the asceticism, he called it Atta Gilamatanu Yoga. It means the practice of literally tiring yourself. That's Gilamata. So people tire themselves out with that striving. When they rest and relax, as many of you feel, after a couple of days, a nice retreat, you don't, you know, need to do so much, take it easy, you feel energized. And that energy is not just energy of the body, because you had enough energy of the body, it's the energy of the mind. It starts to want to engage with the task, because it's energized. It's like putting the good fuel in your car, now you can go somewhere. You've got to get the fuel in there first of all. And you get this wonderful deep insight that the way to get energy of the mind is through stillness. As Ajahn Chah said, and that's actually, it's in the suttas as well, the energy of the body comes from exercise, also food as well. The energy of the mind comes from stillness, through peace. Not through craving, striving, but through stilling everything. That's where you get energy. If you get that insight, you'll understand how meditation works. You'll understand why, when you keep craving and striving and striving for things, you don't get anywhere. You just wear yourself out. When you've got restlessness, when you've got frustrated, when nothing is working, just be still. Don't try and make it different. If the more you struggle with the negative states of mind, you're feeding them. The anger-eating demon simile works here. Those negative states of mind, they come from anger, ill will, and they feed on anger and ill will. So if you say, get out of here, I don't want you, restlessness. Get out, I don't want you, sort of crazy mind. Get out, I don't want you, sleepiness. It will just get worse and worse and worse. There's feeding on that. So you get this incredible insight. Again, counterintuitive, which is why it's insight.
Not many people see this, because at first it doesn't make sense, but when you see the big picture, the deep picture, yeah, you understand now, yeah, that does make sense. So you still the mind, and you get all this energy up. And it's a wonderful thing to be able to do. Sometimes as a young monk it just happened by chance. Sometimes, you know, you took it easy. Sometimes, you know, you just managed to drop into stillness and you had all this energy coming up. And sometimes it's true you can't sleep at night because you've got energy. And where's that come from? Because you've been still. You try and strive. By the end of the night you just get so tired. When you're still and doing very little, you don't need to sleep so much. But you also get the great insight. It's not just the sake of stillness itself. You'll also notice the relation between the more still you are and the more happy you are. Which is another incredible insight. Sometimes you wonder why people just don't see that. You know, you've got to sort of knock your head and say, come on, that's been so clear, it's been right in front of my eyes for years. That when you get very, very still and peaceful, the mind brightens up. And whatever you see, whatever you hear, whatever you taste is more full of delight. So the experience which I had, first retreat, again I was still a student at Cambridge, we hired two boarding houses and we just had a room in the boarding house each, there's only a few of us meditating this time. And we did a 9-day retreat. So it wasn't the most conducive of surroundings. But, you know, it was a nice place to do some meditation, and the teacher was good. And we're doing breath meditation all day. But, in the morning, I think it was between 6 and 7, we were encouraged to go for a walk before breakfast, to have some exercise. And every morning I went for a walk to the Botanical Gardens, which was quite close by. And I knew Cambridge because I was a student there. So that would be a nice place for exercise. It was only about 3 or 4 minute walk from the boarding house, and when we got to those botanical gardens, I couldn't go any further. It was 8 of the 9 days I was there on that retreat. I stopped at the entrance. The other 9th day I decided to get some exercise. I went to the river instead. But on this first day I got to the entrance of the botanical gardens, and there at the entrance was a clump of bamboo. My goodness, I've never seen such a beautiful clump of bamboo in my life. It was like out of these Japanese paintings, or these Chinese watercolours. Just the nearest, the way the bamboo is like thick at the bottom, and it sort of, it gets more and more slender, and as it gets slender it curves in this beautiful arc. And its colours, you know, the greens, and when it gets to the knots, how it sort of fades into yellow, and this is perfectly proportioned spaces between each stem to the next stem. And the leaves were just so delicate and almost sensual, just the way they sort of were slender, and then they just came to a beautiful point. And because there was an early morning breeze, it was just swaying, like dancing, like some sort of ballet out of Tchaikovsky in the morning breeze. I was entranced by it. I never realized there was such beauty to be found in the botanical gardens. And I was standing there for about 10 minutes. Maybe 5, I can't remember how long. And I noticed, I thought somebody's going to look at me and going to take me away, just standing, staring at a clump of bamboo. Because, you know, there are some really crazy students, they probably thought I was on some LSD or something. So I saw there was a bench nearby, so I just sat down on the bench, and I could just sit down and stare at that clump of bamboo. And it was only because of the craving for breakfast that you had to tear yourself away from that, and just go to have your breakfast. But I went back there the next day, and the next day, and the next day, for 8 days. For the 9, I just stared at that incredibly beautiful clump of bamboo. And you know, that was almost like 8 hours. I never tired from exploring and seeing what was there. And it was, oh, it was amazing. So the retreat finished, and then I went back to do some studies, and had a free afternoon. So I thought, what can I do? I'll go and see that beautiful clump of bamboo. So I got on my bike, you know, as students do in Cambridge, and you sort of weave your way through the traffic, getting stressed out. And by the time I got to the Botanical Gardens and parked my bike, there was a clump of bamboo. Remember, this is England. Bamboo is not supposed to grow in such cold climates. And it was the most thin, depressing, you know, spindly, uninspiring, sort of a bush which should really be taken out, clump of bamboo you'd ever seen in the world. And it was a shock to me. So where's my beautiful bamboo gone? It hadn't been replaced, it was the same clump of bamboo. But now it looked just completely uninspiring. And I realized then why. The clump of bamboo was always the same. But in my meditation retreat, my mind had become strong. And just the clump of bamboo just became, oh, so amazingly beautiful. So much so it took my attention away for 8 days. Now that's just an experience which I never understood at first. Sometimes when it's not explained to you, you think, you know, your mind's going a bit crazy. But now that I know how that mind works, the more still it is, the more happiness it has. And the sign of happiness is whatever you see, whatever you hear, whatever you feel, whatever you know, is infused with joy. Anything. I'm not joking, but sometimes that when you get into deep meditation, you go to the toilet, look at your shit in the bowl, and think, wow, that's amazing. Look at the browns and the colours in there and the shape of it. Gee. That's what happens. Simply because whatever you look at is delightful. It's actually one of the meditations which monks are supposed to do, meditating on a decaying corpse. And this is standard. You know, the monks, they watch his decaying corpse and after a while it gets so still and calm. Even like rotting flesh looks actually beautiful. And sometimes you do like a skull meditation. And after a while that skull looks so beautiful, it just gets brilliant and radiant, literally, and becomes an imitator. This is what the mind does. And you get insight. Once you get these experiences, what's happening here? Why is shit look so beautiful? And you know the reason why. It's nothing to do with the object out there. Stillness creates that happiness and joy, and whatever you experience now becomes happy. And then also you start to think of the opposite. You know, all the things which look ugly, which are detestable, which I hate. Is it them or is it me? Is it my husband's fault? Or is it just being a husband? Is it because my mind is tired and depressed and just no energy left? Now you've got some deep insights into life. It's not life's fault. Life is just life. Husbands are husbands, wives are wives, kids are kids. I don't know how many people complain about the 14, 15 year old boys and girls. Usually about 16 year old girls, they complain about 14 year old boys. But you know, it does change a bit. But because kids are being kids, boys are being boys, girls are being girls, partners are being partners, monks are being monks, nuns are being nuns. This is just what life does. But it's what we add on to our attitude. Now that's what's creating the happiness and suffering. You are getting some powerful insights. And of course you're getting one of the deepest of insights, not just how to meditate and how it works, stillness, seeing the beauty in things, or arousing that beauty in things, and so clumps of bamboos do really stand out. And in fact, a clump of bamboo looks beautiful. Imagine what it's like when you close your eyes and watch your breath. It's not this dusty, spindly, dry old breath anymore. As you get into the meditation, you watch the breath, and oh, it's just amazing, it's so nice. And you can stay on the breath for hours. Easy. If you haven't got energy, maybe 1 or 2 minutes at most, and then you go off into plans of where you're going to go next, go into fantasies, go into sort of dreams of the past or whatever. It's nothing to do with you can't do it. Don't think that you haven't got enough will or skill. It's just you should have done some more resting first of all, build up the energies, and then it's easy to watch the breath. You're getting understanding, which makes this whole path of meditation just so easy. You know how it works. So I look at my breath, and if I'm really tired, waste of time looking at my breath, just relax more, do some loving kindness, make peace, draw my heart's open to whatever's happening. Just take it easy. And I know that's the best way, because the energy is built up. When the energies are built up enough, then I go back to the breath, and oh, it's so easy to do. And you're having fun, you're not frustrated anymore. You're enjoying the path. It becomes a path without groaning, as I said the first night. And that's what the Buddha said. Monks, nuns,
lay men, lay women, this path I'm teaching is a path with no groaning at all. It leads all the way to enlightenment with a smile. Wow, that's the path for me. I don't like all this groaning business. I did enough of that at school, in university. You do enough of that at work. You do enough of that in the car going to work in the morning. So no more groaning. Ah, oh, isn't that lovely? So you understand why that works. And that insight into the nature of the path and how things work just make meditation so easy. And get into the breath very, very simply. And that takes time. Sometimes you can't get there immediately because the causes and conditions aren't right. But you know how to get those causes and conditions into place. And that's all you can do. You put them into place and it's easy. And you get some deeper insights as well. Because you understand this is a path without groaning, you get into these states of meditation. They're not only peaceful, but they get happy. You know, everything starts to look beautiful. And you're getting a lot of joy coming up. And sometimes you wonder, what's going on here? I've got no sex, no movies, got no menu for the lunch or the breakfast. You know, I'm only eating in the morning time. What most people think is a very boring, even, you know, this level, an ascetic way of spending your holidays. You're having a great time. That's why when so many people go home from a retreat, they say go back to Singapore or to Sydney or Malaysia or wherever, they say, oh, what did you do for Easter? What did you do for your holidays? Yeah, I went to a retreat, got up 4 o'clock every morning, did this really boring chanting, and just sat on my bum for 9 days. They do think you're crazy. So no, why don't you get a life? You know, go to Paris. Or, you know, at least sort of go to Sydney and see the Opera House and the bridge. Or, you know, go to this beautiful, the Kimberleys, these beautiful waterfalls and forests and stuff. What do you mean you're just in a monastery for 9 days and that's your retreat? And then you give them the kiddies so you paid for it as well. Well, then you're really crazy. But that's what they say. But how you feel? And so many people say this is the best holiday of the year. That's why they do come all the way from Singapore. They've only got a few days holiday a year. And instead of actually going somewhere else, they come to a retreat. Why? Because they understand what real happiness is. It's one of the sayings of the Buddha, which, is one of the great ones, and really sort of shocked me when I first read it, and continues to really amaze me. Very pithy saying, he said, whatever ordinary people say is happiness, the enlightened ones say is suffering. What the ordinary people say is suffering, the enlightened ones recognize as happiness. Basically, the world's got it completely the wrong way around. He was challenging. So what's the happiest things in the world? Movies, sex, family? The enlightened ones say that's suffering. And I love stirring people up. Saying sex, that's suffering. Come on. I know you've been a monk for over 30 years, but you should remember something. But that really stirs people up, because that is, you know, really poking deep. And, yeah, it is. But you can't know that, you know, just in theory, but it's very suggestive, because, you know, this Buddha was a very, very, very wise person, at least. And everybody recognizes that. If you're a Buddhist, say, this fellow had everything. You know, had the works. And so if he said that that is suffering, how can you know that? Now you're finding out what happiness is when you're meditating. Doing absolutely nothing. Keeping still. And you get all this happiness coming up. And sometimes you get so deep in meditation, you get the biggest happiness you've ever had. And that blows you away. Even nimitta stage is huge happiness. When you get to jhanas, that takes the ground away from you and what you thought life was all about. That just spins you. Because you've never known so much happiness before. And it's happiness which comes. Not from getting things, not from accumulating stuff, not from controlling. It came from completely abandoning as much as you possibly can, from letting go, from being still, and building up that stillness,
And that's one of the reasons why I teach these retreats. Eventually, so you taste those jhanas. Just taste them once. At least get to nimitta and get these incredible blisses where you think you can explode with pleasure. Not physical pleasure, but the mental stuff. It's powerful. Then you'll understand what the Buddha said. What the enlightened ones say is happiness. Ordinary people think it's suffering. You're sitting there with your eyes closed, absolutely still. How can you do that? You must be holding your body so tight. That would be torture. I think in Guantanamo Bay they call this like a stress posture, isn't it what it's called? You have to stay in one position for so long, and that's supposed to be torturing you. So you eventually confess to whatever they want you to confess to, whether you did it or didn't do it. But nevertheless, when you're actually sitting still this way for many hours in deep meditation, oh, you're just so blissed out and so happy. It's not stress at all. And it's actually the soldiers are the ones who are stressing out. People working and rushing about and going backwards and forwards and thinking. For me, thinking is a stress position. That's torture. So, you understand from your deep experience something about the nature of happiness. And you recognize that what that was explained as by the Buddha, central teaching of the Buddha is Four Noble Truths. The Buddha was actually teaching what is happiness, what is suffering. You are now getting deep insight into the Four Noble Truths. Real insight from your own experience. Especially the Third Noble Truth, which I focused on the other morning. Just giving, expecting nothing back in return. Throwing things away. Just, this is good enough, being free wherever you are. I don't want to be anywhere else, this moment's good enough for me. And just, nothing sticks to you. The Buddha called that the path to end of craving, to enlightenment, to the ultimate happiness. Now, you've walked a long way on that path. You have let go a lot. And you get this incredible bliss. Which is why, even in the first jhana, the Buddha called that bliss Sambodhi Sukha, enlightenment happiness. Everybody knows that it's not enlightenment, but it's so close. It gives you your first taste of what enlightenment is. Not as a theory, but as an experience. And you're experiencing it. Anyone who's experienced a jhana, and you read that, you cry. You're tasting what the Buddha tasted. This is no small thing. This is huge. You've waited lifetimes for this. And now you're literally standing where the Buddha once stood. Or sat, if you like, under the Bodhi tree. Now sometimes when people go to India, pilgrimage to four holy sites, I tell people, don't go to India. Go to the four holy states in the mind. First jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. You don't need a passport or a visa. And it's much easier. And those are the real holy sites, because if Bodh Gaya and Kusinara and other places, if they inspire you, these places will knock your socks off. That's why I never wear any socks, because I've been to those places. They're incredible! And you're experiencing real happiness. And you say, why? See, this is, you've actually done the Third Noble Truth. And you know, that's, you look at it more closely, you've done the Eightfold Path. You've had a right view, a view of renunciation. You've understood the path, you've done the right intention, gentleness, love, and just the letting go. And you've kept your precepts, the third, fourth and fifth. You've actually found out at last what right effort is, because it's worked. You got the insight into that very, very delicate, noble truth of what is actually effort. So you've got that right effort because it's worked. And you have this mindfulness incredibly strong. So powerful, whatever you see, whatever you feel, it just, wow, you can really see into it. And you've got the stillness of samadhi. You've walked the path. So you know what that is. Then you look back and, you know, why is it that sometimes this doesn't work. Second noble truth, craving, craving leads to suffering. And next time you meditate after you've had a deep meditation, you crave, I want it back please, and you'll suffer. That's always, you know, sometimes for women they have this called postpartum depression after you've had sort of a baby. And sometimes you have post-jhana depression after you've had a child. I can't get it back again, because you're craving. So the Dharma is just right there in front of you. The Four Noble Truths are very, very clear because you have the experience. You've got the data to understand it. And the biggest question of your whole life, happiness and suffering, it's right there in front of you. This is what we mean by insight. However, there's more insights which come. Because most times when people think of insight meditation, they don't actually talk about the Four Noble Truths. They also talk about anicca, dukkha, anatta, impermanence, and suffering and non-self. But this is actually what you can also get into. Only when you've got a strong mind can you start to see, for example, what suffering truly is. Which is one of the insights which I teach, and you never hear this in any other insight meditation retreat, you only hear it in these sorts of retreats, is the insight into your past lives. That's called an insight in the suttas. It's not just impermanence, unsatisfactoriness or suffering and non-self. These are also, this is the first insight the Buddha got under the Bodhi tree. Recollection of his past lives. Why is that an insight? Because that gives you the big picture. If it was only about this life, and if at the end of this life, you were going to die and that was it, finished, kaput, gone forever, you might as well just get as much happiness and pleasure as you can, and when you get old, shoot yourself. That would make a lot of sense if this was the only life. Enjoy as much as you can. Before too much suffering comes along, do yourself in. And that would be philosophically, morally understandable. And that's what many people do. But if you saw the bigger picture, this is just one life amongst many, it would change one's whole attitude towards what you're doing. That certainly is a possibility. Because certainly you have no one's ever been able to prove that rebirth doesn't exist. But it's been difficult to prove that rebirth does exist. There is proof out there if people have an open mind. But the most convincing proof is your own experience when you remember who you were before. And this path of meditation gives you the opportunity to do so. If you've had a good meditation, a deep meditation, usually at least to the level of nimittas or after a jhana, but at least the nimittas, and you feel you've got a lot of stillness, a lot of energy, a lot of power in your mind, pause and just ask yourself the question, what is my earliest memory? What is my earliest memory? When the mind is energized with lots of mindfulness, lots of happiness, very still, that mind will be able to recollect early memories. So while the Buddha sometimes said the mind becomes like workable, malleable, able to do its job, at other times it's just too stiff and just it doesn't do anything. But at this particular stage you can just make that suggestion, what's my earliest memory? And if the mind is ready, it's incredible, just the memory comes up into your mind within seconds. A vision, a smell, or something. If it comes, it comes immediately. You don't have to work. You just make that suggestion and then shut up. No struggle. And if it comes very clearly. Not as, is this a past life? Or if anyone comes up to me and say, well, I had this sort of vision, it was sort of like this, and I don't know whether it was or wasn't. The answer is it wasn't. Any doubt at all means it's not the real thing. Because when these things come up, incredible just in the fact that that was you. No doubt at all. Most times it comes an early time of this life, being a baby, being in your mother's womb, or whatever. And that comes, you're back there, you're re-experiencing that time as if it was now. You know, if you open your eyes, but you don't really want to open your eyes because you're enjoying this, you open your eyes, you're back in the room here. Close your eyes, you're back on your mother's womb. Or in the mother's womb again. It's re-experiencing. You've already had some weird experiences in this retreat, some of you. And this is a weird, but it's real. You re-experience things. And the nice thing about when you're re-experiencing these things, you've got enough movement. You know, you can actually move your mind to actually see over here, to see over there, to ask, what's that person's name? And you know straight away, just thinking it. What's their name? And then subverbally, the name will, or rather, you know the name of that person. You know exactly where it is. You can explore those visions of past lives. Which is great, because you can actually get some data. You check, you know, whether what you saw in that sort of vision of a past life, whether it's actually accurate or not. If you had a previous past life, which is not that long ago, and you can actually have records and check out if that was really you. And that, again, blows you away. Yeah, you did live before. You know who you were, and you can get the information, and yeah, there it was. Now that's a powerful insight, which means you don't have to doubt any more about the truth of rebirth. It's a fact. And that gives you the whole big picture of suffering. Because when you realize what it was like to die before, and the time before, and the time before that, when you remember just, you know, what it's like, sort of, now being rich, now being poor, now getting married, now getting divorced, now doing this, now doing that, it gives a sense of, I think the word is ennui. So sort of, not so much boredom, but do I have to do that all over again? It can't be something else. How many times do I have to do this? And it gives you the biggest picture of, you know, what suffering really is in life. Sometimes you have a wonderful life, sometimes it's not so wonderful. Sometimes you get cancer, you know, when you're quite young. Sometimes you're fit and healthy, sometimes you die in wars and all sorts of ways of dying. Sometimes you've been really wealthy. Why? What's the point? When you've had it many, many times, and you see that many times, it gives you a different perspective on what life is all about. And that's an important insight, which will drive you into being more virtuous, more peaceful, meditating more, of leaving that world instead of getting caught up in it again. So that's a valid insight which we teach here. I mention this at this point because some of you are getting into deep meditation. If you get a deep meditation, just experiment, play around. Ask the question, it only takes a second or two. What's my earliest memory? And see if anything comes. If it doesn't come up, drop it immediately. Don't try again. The mind isn't ready yet. Another time, another place, deep meditation, what's my earliest memory? Whoosh, all starts coming up. I should mention, if you get like an early life memory as a little baby, okay, explore it, have fun there. And then when you've had fun there, stop and say, earlier please. It's just like asking your mind, like your mind being a servant. And it's so soft, it's really willing to do whatever you want. So earlier please. But a word of warning there, if you do get your previous life, the first memory of your previous life tends to be when you died last time. And for some people that's not a pleasant experience. So if you get that sort of memory of your last life when you were dying, instead of exploring that, or rather sort of rebelling against that and saying, I don't want to do this anymore, because it's a re-experience. You know, you're right in there, rather than looking from a distance at it, you're inside the scenario. If that happens, just quickly say, earlier please. So you can move back from your death experience to sometime earlier in that life. So you can actually experience the life rather than the ending of that previous life. And that actually stops people getting some negativity, because a couple of people, they've got like a past life experience, they've got the time they were dying, they don't want to do that ever again. It's just too unpleasant. It's important to be able to get those past life memories, so if you can, it's very helpful. So go earlier. As soon as you get that feeling of sort of, I'm dying or whatever, that very, very painful, unpleasant feeling, just earlier please. And the mind will very often oblige and just go to an earlier part of your previous life, which is not so hard to see. That's the experience of previous lives. Now you can understand something more about anicca. coming and going, rise and fall, things coming and passing away. Because you've got the data, you've got a big picture. Just one life is sometimes not enough. Many, many lives, oh, now I'm wealthy, now I'm poor, now I'm a girl, now I'm a boy, now I'm a monk, now I'm a layperson, now I'm rich, now I'm old, now I'm African, now I'm Chinese, now I'm Caucasian, now I'm this, now I'm that. Been here, done that. It gives you that sense of ennui, which comes about by noticing change. But deeper than that, that when one really gets into the deep meditations, I think the deep meditations are the most powerful because they give you data which you can't get anywhere else. And these are data which just really rock the sense of who you thought you were. Because when you get into the jhanas, especially, I always like the second jhana in this explanation, because in the second jhana, so much is different. Sometimes you can call it an altered state of consciousness. What's altered? Usually when you get to those meditations many, many times, you can't forget them. They're a source of insight. You keep reflecting on them. What was that? Why was that? How was that? In the second jhana, there's something very strange happens. It's the, you might call it the hallmark of the second jhana. Is you're so still. If you think you've been still before, you've never been as still. You can't be as still. There's no stillness greater than that second jhana. Third and fourth jhanas and above, you might always call them subsets of that second jhana. Because in that second jhana, the will, the doer, has now ceased. It's stopped. There's no doer left. And it's weird, because that's the first time in your existence you felt like that. And as I mentioned, I think yesterday or the day before, it's not as if you don't want to do anything, it's that you can't do anything. It's like the switches of doing and thinking and changing, they're just not just pushed beyond your reach, but they've been just dismantled, they're not there. So you're in a state there where you're perfectly alert and awake, heightened awareness, very, very blissed out, a bliss at a different level. It's one of the other things with the jhanas, you think you know what bliss is. You get into the first jhana, and that just, you never experience anything that powerful and happy before. You think that's the peak. That's why mystics of other traditions, when they get the first jhana, so often they call it union with God. That's what it feels like. The most powerful, blissful experience of your life. Huge energy, huge power, and you're mostly gone. And what most people would expect that to be, you're gone, and power, bliss, incredible love is right there. Maybe like love in a normal sense, no, but the power, the joy, unmoving, long time. And if you were a Catholic and you went to tell the bishop, they now call you saint. You've had union with God, and it's real. That's what they think. It's really just first jhana. There's more than that. So when you get to the second jhana, you think that can't have more bliss than that, and you get even more bliss. It just actually shows you just what happiness can really be. Now you're going to the summits of happiness, and you realize you've been messing around with rubbish happiness all your life, and now you're really getting into it. But in the second jhana, it's not just that the bliss, it's the absolute stillness. The will has disappeared. And this is where that I bring up the simile to understand what I mean here of the tadpole. Tadpole was born in the water, in a nice pond. He lived all its life in the water. And while it was living in the water, it went to many meditation retreats with other tadpoles. And it also studied Buddhist philosophy, and other philosophy as well. And in the books they always started talking about water, 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 water. And he read many dissertations and explanations of water, and heard many talks of enlightened tadpoles, actually frogs, because they had grown up, about water. But no matter what he heard,
that no matter what he read, no matter how much this little tadpole thought, he could never really understand what water was, because it was always there. It was always around him. He lived in water. He was born in water. How can a tadpole ever know what water is if he's lived in there all his life? Even if he's explained, even if it's taught, even though he reads about it, he still can't know. But one day, tadpole grows legs and becomes a frog. And the frog jumps out of the water for the first time. And when that frog is on the bank, something is missing. Something which was there at every moment of its life, surrounding him, has now disappeared. Only now does he know what water is. Will. You've been living surrounded by will, choice, doing, control. Even though you may not have exercised it, it's been there at your command ever since you were born. Will is always there. And now for the first time in these jhanas, they're standing on the bank. It's not there. It's gone. Now you understand what it is. It does not belong to you. It's not part of you. Doing is anatta. Doesn't belong to me, nothing to do with me, complete conditioning. As I said in many retreats before, you did not decide to come on this retreat. None of you had any choice in the matter. You just came. It appeared that you chose to come. It appeared that you worked so hard. But that was just the appearances. The truth of the matter is, you had to come. That's why you're here. For those of you who got up early this morning and thought how great you were, you got up at 4 o'clock at last, don't get up yourselves. You had no choice. For those of you who slept in, don't worry about it. You had no choice. Those of you who got jhana, don't think how great you are. It just had to happen. Those of you who are struggling and haven't even got to the present moment awareness yet, don't worry. It was nothing to do with you. You had no choice. What freedom. That's what I mean. You don't do anything because there's nothing to do. There's no one to do it. When you stop doing things, you get into jhana almost immediately. There's no one there to do things. This is a powerful insight. That really rocks you. Again, it's counterintuitive. What do you mean I didn't choose? I know I chose. I was there when I was choosing it. That's what it looked like. But after the second jhana, you'll see it in a different way. You're completely conditioned. That's why every time that people complain to me about my stupid jokes, nothing to do with me. Absolutely nothing to do with me. The reason I tell stupid jokes is my father told stupid jokes. He conditioned me. It's in my genes. If I say anything profound in Dharma, it's nothing to do with me at all. It's to do with my teacher, Ajahn Chah. Because I've got it from him. He got it from Ajahn Mun. He got it from somebody else. Eventually it gets down to the Buddha. And the Buddha got it from his master in a previous life who was Kassapa the Buddha. So it all just keeps going down. It's nothing to do with me. It's all this beautiful condition process. And for those of you, John at the back there, who read that wonderful sutta in the Anguttara Thames about this conditional process of how you become enlightened, it's in that one, not only mentions a fault-finding mind, but also mentions this great statement, to become enlightened somewhere you've got to listen to the words of another enlightened being. Without that, enlightenment is impossible. Wow, why? This is how the seed, there is a transmission in Theravada Buddhism. You get conditioned. And so, I don't care if people argue with what's being said here, or if they reject it. It's too late now. It's in your mind. You have been brainwashed. It's far too late. So never mind. This is what happens. And you find that when you meditate, and some of you, you let go here and you get this deep meditation here, and you ask, wow, I've done it. You haven't done it. I did it. I got you into that deep meditation. And it's not really me. It's my teacher did that. It's Ajahn Chah. And it's the Buddha worked. That's why you got into deep meditation. The Buddha's conditioning, his Dharma, has got into you through many, many other teachers. And that's why at a certain time in the meditation, you've actually let go. You've renounced what you thought was an act of will coming from you. How good you are, I can do it, alas. Nothing to do with you at all. It's just the Dharma going through you. The wheel of the Dharma rolling in the world, in the people. It's fascinating when you see it that way. It is part of this whole process. Whether you like it or not, you're going to get enlightened. So you might as well like it rather than lump it. It's a very pleasant path. And it gives you, this is what non-self is all about. Isn't it beautiful? You know, this, I don't have to worry about anything. It just happens. Sometimes people say, if there's no will, why do anything? Why even get up in the morning? And the answer is, because you've got no choice. Why meditate? You've got no choice. So you think it's your choosing, but you know, it just happens. You have to get up in the morning, you have to do these things, you have to. But don't think ever it's you. It's what we call the driverless bus. I better stop because I'm going over time. The driverless bus. You know, you think there's a bus there, you go to the driver's seat, the full simile you've heard before, many of you, you find there's no one driving this bus. That's a shock. It's a beautiful relief after a while. The bus is you, your body and mind. And you always think that you're in control, you're driving it. You really think you can decide to walk out now. You're not free to do that. Go on. Sometimes you think you can do this, you can do that. After a while, you find out, who is this doer? This driver of me? And in meditation, in deep meditation, you get to the driver's seat. You go in. What drives me? Where is that driver's seat inside my body and mind? And that's important to find out, because that's the troublemaker. That gets you frustrated, gets you angry, gets you fed up. Why are you angry? You say, I can't do it. I can't meditate. I can't get peaceful. I can't do this. That's the driver. Look in there, there's no one there. Empty. And the result of that is, instead of complaining, you just go and sit down in your seat and shut up. You just sit on your chair or your cushion and you just watch your breath go in, watch your breath go out, and stop complaining, for goodness sake. There's no one to complain to. That works, it doesn't work. You get peaceful, you get restless, now you get blissed out, now you get a sexual fantasy, now you sort of get tired, now you get hungry. Stop complaining. No driving. Who's there to complain to? It means you let go of craving. You let go of craving. Everything gets really beautiful and peaceful and nice. So, that gives you an idea of what insight really is. Not only does it show you how to meditate, not only does it really get you some incredibly powerful realizations of what happiness is, it answers some of the biggest questions of religion and philosophy. Were you before? How were you before? Are you now? What are you now, if anything? What drives the world? What drives you? When you realize all of that, it's empty. What a relief when you've got no one to worry about. It's like when you become a monk or a nun, you give up the three crooked things. And when you get in line, you give up the fourth crooked thing, your stupid mind. You know what I mean by being crooked? If anything is crooked, your mind is the most crooked, the biggest crook. You're always deceiving, promising this and never living up to it, always deceiving, lying, swindling. I've been swindled by my mind, but no longer mind. You give up the four crooked things. The housework, the ladle, the husband or the wife, and lastly, the mind. And then you're free at last. You're the real monk
or none. Okay, so that's deep insight. Da da da. Any questions? Any questions on that? Yes, we got one up there. I'm very glad you asked the question. You didn't really have any choice. So, good job you submitted.
There is no the mind conditioned process, so the principle is put away naturally and coming towards happiness, or to see happiness today. It's the best thing that we could possibly do to, I guess, speed along our path. It's not the will, but to be happy.
Here's the best thing in life. Just to speed along the process, not to win anything, but just to be happy. It's just not really, because you can't speed up the process. The best thing is just listen to the teachings of the Buddha. I would always say that's the best thing to do. But that just sort of, you know, is a great conditioning. It conditions you out of samsara. So you're getting you're getting the will from the Buddha. And he was pretty good at getting enlightened, so that's the best teacher. So you put that in your brain, and you soon get out of samsara. Yes.
When you said words of enlightened being, does that include like teachings of the Buddha or certain meanings that in your Vishwakarma or Tathagata and all that make from?
Yeah, it's when you say that the teachings of the enlightened ones are a necessary ingredient for the attainment of enlightenment, even like for stream winning. Does it mean like the teachings of the Buddha? When the commentaries saw that teaching of the Buddha, they actually said, oh yeah, now that's even the suttas, what you can read, is enough. And I think sometimes maybe yes, maybe no. Because sometimes, unless the suttas are really explained by someone's experienced them, and sometimes they don't come to life. So you can see the words there, and all the teachings are there, but sometimes you really do need like a great teacher, a great master or mistress or whatever, nun or monk, or even layperson who's got something, to really bring them to life. And they do that. And sometimes, you know, you can listen to a sutta, you can read it yourself, and then listen to it being explained. Wow, I never saw that. It was there, but sometimes that you need an enlightened person to bring it out. So, maybe about a couple of years ago, I thought maybe the suttas were enough, but I think really you do need someone to give that little bit of zest to them.
The Buddha been in past life, then?
Yeah. Oh yeah, that's right, if it's a past life. Yeah, because remember, when Siddhartha Gautama, before he got enlightened, the first thing he remembered under the Bodhi tree was his previous lives, one of which was under Kassapa. So he would have remembered all the teachings. This was before his enlightenment. He would have remembered the teachings which he got from Kassapa the Buddha, before his enlightenment. Yes. Oh, you do change things, but it's not you doing the changing.
So, it sounds common, like it's already.
Oh, not really.
Already there.
Is
that?
It's going to change it. Yes and no, because it's depending on which way you look at these things. We look at it from internally, and you're always, you know, making decisions, making choices, as you always will do. So you're not saying, and this is important, sometimes people get confused when I give this talk on will, you're not saying that choice does not exist. Choosing, even willing, striving, deciding, that's a given. You can see that happening. Now I'm saying, where is it coming from? What causes that choice, that will? When you start investigating that, you can start to see that it's not from a person, it's not from you, it's from all these influences on you. We've had a huge influence on this retreat, which is why that sometimes it gets easier to meditate on a retreat like this, because you've been brainwashed, you've been conditioned, influenced. And your choices, which you make seemingly freely, you know, you can see how I've influenced many of those choices on this retreat. Now you can extrapolate that to see all your choices, where they really come from. So choice is, it exists, but it's not coming from Irene. That's a fascinating one. It's hard to see until you become a frog and jumped up onto that bank and oh, this water's gone. Now you know what water is when there's no more water left. Which is a great time to stop because we have interviews now. So, have a nice time meditating. But please don't think about will and confuse yourself the next couple of hours. Instead, just drop it all, let go, develop nice meditation, and then experience rather than thinking about it. Otherwise, you drive yourself crazy. Okay.